Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, in the last few months, I've talked variously about the preparations that India made in the run-up to the Second World War, and the strategic position that India finds itself in between 1939 and 1940. But today I want to talk more about Afghanistan, and the reason why Afghanistan is such an interesting topic of exploration in the late 1930s is because it is sandwiched between the Soviet Union and the British Empire. Afghanistan had obviously been a theatre between the great powers in the 19th century, and it would intermittently be the same during the 20th century. But Afghanistan, as a sovereign nation during the 1930s, was beset by dilemmas, especially as the world situation darkens towards the end of the decade. As we know from previous recordings, in September 1939, Lord Linlithgow, the Viceroy of India, declared war on Germany along with Great Britain. But he did it unilaterally, didn't consult the Congress or any other of India's political structures, the princely states or anything like that. He did it unilaterally. And right away, the deployment of Indian forces to East Africa, the Middle East and Singapore is used not only to support the rest of the British Empire, but also to secure kind of like a perimeter around India. But the situation in Afghanistan occupied the thoughts of the Indian government and also in Westminster. Now, I'm going to read from Srinath Raghavan's really excellent book, India's War. Here, Srinath Raghavan argues that the weight of history, and particularly the history of Afghanistan, the Northwest Frontier and all that, informed British decision-making. He writes, "In the early months of the war, however, Britain did not draw on any additional Indian resources. London, as well as New Delhi, remained fixated on a traditional threat to India from Russia via Afghanistan. It was believed that with Britain locked out in a long conflict on the continent, Europe, it would only be logical for the Kremlin to give a free rein to expansionist tendencies inherent in the character of the Soviet state, especially in areas of its traditional interest such as Afghanistan. The government of Afghanistan was even more apprehensive on this score. For several years it had hankered after a British guarantee against the threat of aggression from Russia. The Afghan Prime Minister had even visited London in 1937 to press for such a guarantee, to no avail. Although desultory talks had been carried out until the eve of the war, London had been leery of any binding commitment. Britain did not want to tie itself down in advance in a fluid international situation. Moreover, it was well understood that the Indian Army, the chief instrument for executing any guarantee, was in the throes of reorganisation and consequently was in no shape to assist Afghanistan. So in the in March of 1939, Britain and France guaranteed Poland's independence, or they at least guaranteed to defend Poland in the face of aggression. And this gave the Afghans hope that there would be a similar kind of provision offered to them. The Poles were well aware that they faced not just the threat of Germany, but also the threat of the Soviet Union. And Afghanistan imagined that it might be seen in a similar light, not out of any great charity on the part of the British, but they knew that the British would not want Soviet forces on the Indian border. They would not want, certainly, the Soviet Union being able to control Afghan air bases from which to bomb India. The British were prepared to offer a kind of a treaty of understanding, a non-aggression pact, and an agreement of mutual consultations, which meant that, at the insistence of India, that no troops were guaranteed to be deployed to Afghanistan. It might be, it could be argued that this was short-sighted in India's case, and that deploying troops to Afghanistan might have been, in the event of a possible Soviet invasion, the wisest thing to do. This rather lacklustre offer to the Afghans came at the same time, roughly, as the Nazi-Soviet Pact in August 1939, and thus rendering the gesture of goodwill pretty much meaningless. So once the war had broken out, Britain's Foreign Office and the India Office, both in London, began to look at Afghanistan more carefully. The desire to preserve Afghanistan as a buffer state, an independent one, was essential to the defence of India and to the defence of the British Empire overall. The shock of the Nazi-Soviet Pact had reverberated throughout Europe and America, and obviously Great Britain. And prior to it being signed, it was hard to believe, really, that the Soviet Union, gripped in its own inner turmoil and bloody internal violence, would present much of a threat to its neighbours. Stalin was traditionally fixated not on Afghanistan, but on Poland, Germany and Japan. But in the minds of military planners in London and then in Delhi, the Nazi-Soviet Pact meant that all bets were off and that no assumption could be safely relied on. And this actually meant that Afghanistan had more leverage. It was important now to keep Afghanistan on the side of Great Britain. And Germany, throughout the 1930s, had developed more, increasing commercial interests in Afghanistan. There were significant numbers of German technicians and engineers in the country. And obviously there was a well-established intelligence operation there, with information being fed back to Berlin, and also diplomatic ties that could pull Afghanistan closer into a German orbit. India sent a military mission to Kabul, and it was hinted or intimated that if a crisis did happen, that the British and Indians would actually commit troops to Afghanistan to ensure its notional independence. The Afghans were, of course, keen to avoid antagonising the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union were not imminently looking to attack Afghanistan, but the situation that normally befalls countries who accept defence pacts when they exist wedged between two empires, is that the assistance from outside alone can sometimes decide the country's fate. And so the Afghan Prime Minister was happy to procrastinate, to avoid being seen to be outwardly allying itself with hostile powers to the Soviet Union. But in early November 1939, when the Soviet Union invaded Finland, the Afghans were shocked again. So these two game changes, the Nazi-Soviet Pact in August 1939 and the invasion of Finland in November 1939, showed that the view of the Soviet Union was fast becoming obsolete, that it was a kind of a sleeping giant that is best not to awaken. Well, the reality for the Finns was the giant was awoken and ready to act. It just so happens that everything had gone particularly badly for the Russians in Finland during the Winter War of 1939-40. When the Brigadier G.N. Molesworth, who was the Director of Military Operations in India, was sent to Afghanistan to find out precisely what the Afghans needed, he quickly learned that there were no plans at all, no contingency plans for an emergency, so nothing really to base Afghanistan's needs on. During and after the first meeting, the Afghans drew up a long shopping list of military material, aircraft, tanks, and all the other stuff of modern warfare, where the reality was that planning, training, structure, and organisation would generally have done an awful lot more. It was air attacks that occupied the thoughts of the British and the Indians. The idea that the Red Army might be able to cross through Afghanistan and then into India itself was seen as fanciful. Probably the terrain would make it impassable, but aircraft could bomb Indian cities, and this would cause devastation to the British Empire in India and beyond. And the Indian government in 1939 had one anti-aircraft battery consisting of 8 3-inch guns, so you'd have been hard pressed to shoot down a single fighter aircraft on that basis, and there were indeed no fighter aircraft whatsoever. Now, if you recall, I've talked about Britain's defence of the Far East recently.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And Britain's defence of the Far East, from everything that I've read, and I've read a considerable amount on the subject, showed how underprepared for the Japanese onslaught British were, and potentially how underprepared they would have been for a Soviet onslaught in Asia too. And the reason for this is that the British Empire in 1919 reaches its zenith in terms of territory, and also it is an enormously indebted empire after the First World War. So the greater commitments, far less finance and capital to go round, and also far less manpower, in that the First World War had killed off an entire generation of men who would have been imperial administrators and imperial soldiers, or the good ones anyway. So you have an immensely weakened empire that, for example, can't provide the jewel in the crown of the empire, India, with anything like adequate air defences. And this is a big clue as to why Japan is able to advance so rapidly across the Asian British Empire in late 1941, early 1942. Even a light air attack would exacerbate internal security problems in India and lead to open rebellions, which were close to exploding into life by the early 1940s anyway. The Japanese reckoned on this same strategy, that India probably didn't need to be invaded by a dozen Japanese divisions. All it needed was for some set-piece battles to go in Japan's way along the Indian border, and uprisings would spark themselves, thus unseating the British from their treasured imperial possession, ending British world power, and creating a new useful client state there that the Japanese could have some claim to having liberated. If domestic uprisings rob Britain of its vast army of Indian labour and military manpower, India might have to be garrisoned by British troops from Europe, or Australian troops, or New Zealand or Canadian troops, thus drawing manpower away from other important theatres. So India presented the possibility of a catastrophic crisis in imperial planning. From London, the British Foreign Office and War Office looked on at the Winter War in Finland and drew conclusions from it. On the 6th of December, writes Srinath Ravagan, on the 6th of December 1939, the Foreign Office circulated a memorandum arguing that Russia was well poised for an expansionist policy towards Afghanistan. Such a move would clearly enjoy the full support of Germany. Moscow could aim to grab parts of northern Afghanistan either by an outright military attack or by a combination of military pressure, political intrigue, and propaganda. The Red Army had shown itself quite capable of occupying territory against an enemy unprovided with the means of modern means of defence. While an attack on India was still seen as improbable, Soviet penetration into Afghanistan would be a definite advantage in this direction and would deal a grave blow to Britain's prestige. Days before the Finnish surrender, the chiefs of staff insisted that Germany and the Soviet Union have for the moment common interests in achieving the disruption of the British Empire, important parts of which could be attacked from Russia. Germany would be willing to provide such assistance as the Russians would be willing to accept. The Afghans didn't want to commit to anything that the British proposed without knowing fully what the British intended to do in the case of a Russian attack. It wanted clear definitions and didn't want to wind up inviting a Soviet attack and then having the British back out at the last minute. When in the spring and summer of 1940 the German army swept across the Low Countries and France, the view that Afghans had of the British and their military prowess and their ability to defend Afghanistan began to dramatically decline. Younger Afghan nationalists within the Afghan government began to question whether it was right to tilt towards Britain, to favour Britain in the combatant great powers. There were numerous examples across the Islamic world, from Egypt to Iraq, all the way to Afghanistan, and Palestine, of nationalist sympathies not falling in with Germany out of any sense of affinity, but a sense of either the enemy of my enemy is my friend, or who can confer upon us the greatest opportunities for national self-determination. When France fell and the British Expeditionary Force was evacuated from Dunkirk, Afghanistan looked to Britain with a sense of disbelief and horror. The British offered a token arms supply of 5,000 rifles and ammunition to be sent from India, but it was actually turned down by the Afghans, who wanted either a significant amount of arms worthy of justifying the risk of provoking the USSR, or nothing at all. Srinath Raghavan writes, "It was evident that Kabul now sought to defuse the Russian threat by other means. The first indication of this was the signing of a trade agreement with the Soviet Union towards the end of July 1940. Over the next few months, the threat of Soviet invasion of Afghanistan visibly receded." Okay, so eventually there is no invasion. And in a way, whether there is an invasion or not, that's slightly beside the point. Because what this story tells us is a change in power relations within the British Empire and within the British Empire's satellites. Here you have Afghanistan, a country that in the 1840s saw offer a British invasion and roundly humiliated the British, and that was a country that was fiercely independent, but nevertheless fell within an overall British sphere of influence, or British Indian sphere of influence. But by 1940, was actually saw it was wiser to turn down whatever lukewarm offer of British help was on the table. This tells us that the view that the Afghans had of the British as being a safe military bet and a state to ally itself with is in decline, not just because of the weaknesses of the British Empire, but also because of the realities of the Second World War up until 1942, late 1942, early 1943. The British far from cover themselves in glory, and it is the setbacks, the losses, the defeats and the disappointments that send a message to much of the rest of the world that the British, as a great power, have gone into decline, and that the British aren't really the great power that they had been a century beforehand. And if the Afghans had been able to observe this, and it had shaped Afghan policy towards the British and towards the Soviet Union, and had moved Afghanistan to a much more conciliatory position with the Soviet Union, looking to trade, looking to de-escalate things, then certainly that same reality would have been observable from much of the rest of the world. And it's particularly observable by the Americans, who are aware that Britain no longer really commands the place in the world that it once did. In reality, the plan to defend Afghanistan, creating a defensive line at Kabul and a second one in the Helmand province, was when the British War Ministry looked at it, and the Treasury, wildly unrealistic, and would have involved a huge concentration of manpower, material and money. Finally, a watered-down and manpower-light plan to defend Afghanistan emerged, one without aircraft. And Whitehall essentially said that India would have to make do with the forces that it had been allocated to defend Afghanistan and, I quote, accept the risks involved in operations undertaken with relatively small forces and without air support, i.e. annihilation. And the British would learn in places like Norway that, to their ultimate chagrin, that relatively light forces without armour, artillery, or air cover were doomed to defeat. Anyway, we're going to finish that. I hope you've enjoyed this, and do remember, if you want to support the Explaining History podcast, please check out our Patreon page. We rely on a little trickle of ad revenue and the generosity of our patrons. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.